From WXXI News, this is Arts Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This hour on Arts Friday, we talk about the connection between art and our environment. And there is a film festival coming up. There are submissions going on. And we're going to talk about the Fast Forward Film Festival that invites emerging and established filmmakers from the greater Rochester area here in Western New York to submit to this first annual Fast Forward Film Festival that's coming up here. So we're going to talk about what it is and why, and I think the why is a very, very important part of the conversation. Our guests in studio are going to help explain, and let me go ahead and introduce them now. Andy Stern is here. He's the executive director of the Lost Bird Project, and we're going to talk about Lost Bird in a moment, because Andy, I think some people may recognize the phrase Lost Bird, but it's been a few years now, and so we're going to talk about what you've been doing with that. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Todd McGrain is here. Artist, filmmaker, film festival juror, and Lost Bird Project as well. That's a lot of hats for you.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And Nora Brown is here. She is a film commissioner is the easy title. You're the executive director of the Rochester and Finger Lakes Film and Video Office.
That's
is that
correct.
The full title?
That's correct, yes.
It's one of the, it's like you're a doctor. There's lots of, it's a long title.
Less words.
But the doctor in here is Dr. Andy Stern. And Andy, with the Lost Bird Project, before we even get to the film festival, let's go back a few years and let's just talk about what the Lost Bird Project is. For me, it is a sad but really moving idea. Tell us about it.
Well, it really started with a film. It started with Todd's sculpture. Todd had made five larger-than-human bronzes of five extinct North American birds and wanted to install them in the sites where that species was last seen in the wild. And I said, wow, I want to be a part of that. So we spent 2.5 years doing that project. We made a film about it, involved local communities, local governments, bird watchers, citizens, and the film was a hit. It's been on public television many, many times throughout this country and, in fact, internationally, and opened a lot of doors. And we had so much fun doing it. Todd and I said, well, let's keep going. It was around that time that I really felt a calling, I would say, to address myself entirely to environmental concerns. I felt just strongly that my job was to raise awareness about what is happening because I was so concerned about it, and so few people really seem to grasp it in its enormity. So that's what I've been doing with the Lost Bird Project. Our mission is to connect more deeply to the earth through art. And all of our projects come under that mission in some way or other. We define art in a wide frame. We work with climate scientists, but we have a very, very different approach. We move people, we touch people, we touch their hearts and souls. We don't advocate for any program. We don't present data, arguments. We don't try to persuade.
But why not advocate for programs if there are certain ones that feel right to you?
There are several answers to that. One is that we don't want to be divisive. Part of the problem around the environmental approach today is there's such polarity about it.
It feels politicized, doesn't it?
Yeah. We want no one to get up and leave the room. We want everyone to feel welcome, to feel comfortable with the language and who we are and what we do. That's one answer. But the other answer is, truly, I'm not sure what to say should be done. It's a big, big, big question, and I don't feel sure enough to tell anyone.
I think that humility is important in this kind of a conversation. I mean, I think we all recognize there are challenges ahead of us, but to some degree, I think it does require some humility to say we don't know and try not to shut out voices. At the same time, are you concerned, Dr. Stern, that if you decide you want to welcome everybody in, no matter their background, and to be able to sit down to whether it's watching a film, having a discussion, some people have to feel somewhat uncomfortable. We have to be somewhat unafraid to make some people uncomfortable, I would think.
Well, we have presented the story of extinct North American birds and memorializing those birds and telling the stories, which are compelling and moving. And there is no one alive who has ever heard that bird song or seen that bird. And we have shown this film and led discussions about it all over the country for several years. We've never had a person leave the room. So that is the kind of content we present.
Todd, remind me and forgive me, where did I see the sculpt? Did I see the sculptures at the Eastman House? That's where it is. Okay, I think we took, was it a year? I'm asking Todd when I was there. But I feel like it was like a year ago taking my son. Were there sculptures there within the last year or so? I'm trying to remember. Was it 2 years ago maybe?
The Memorial Art Gallery has permanently the Passenger Pigeon Memorial. And when I say it has the memorial, it has an addition of that sculpture.
Okay.
We have one addition of each sculpture is placed at the site where the birds were last seen in the wild. And then with Andy's help, we've cast additions, and they're traveling. So one of those additions is permanently placed at the Memorial Art Gallery here in Rochester. Mm-hmm. And then we currently have a set at the Smithsonian in Washington. There's a set out in California. They're in Chicago at the Nature Museum. So we're keeping that show on the road, literally, keeping the sculptures moving and giving us a chance to tell stories about the lost birds.
What drew your attention as an artist and your sentimentality toward extinct birds?
You know, the roots of artistic inspiration and artistic ambition are always hard to put your finger on, because it's not a kind of advertisement where you say, what I want to do is address this concern, therefore I'll make these things. And most often for artists, the making comes first. So, you know, the project started with a bucket of clay, and as that bucket of clay, you know, as I pushed that material around, this duck form emerged out of it, not unlike other forms I've made, but while I was working on that sculpture, I was given a book by Chris Kokinos called Hope is the Thing with Feathers. And Chris's book is a personal account of his wrestling with the loss of species during his lifetime. And, you know, that with that book sort of resonating, when I returned to the studio, that sculpture became a memorial. And then the next step was realizing that the ambition of having these sculptures stand as memorials to lost species wouldn't really be complete until they were placed at meaningful sites.
I've heard conversations and I've seen people writing and debating online about the question of extinction, because right now there's 7+ billion people. You know, there was 1 or 2 billion people in 1950. By the time my son is 65, there may be 10 or 14 billion people. And extinction of other species is almost inevitably, well, we know it's going to happen. So this is kind of an odd question for Todd and Dr. Stern, but do you accept that as the, if whatever you want to call it, progress or the natural course of human history, just in terms of our population and our growing population, do we accept that extinction of other species happens, or are you memorializing as a way to warn us to not be cavalier about it?
Well, certainly the latter is the case. I think being cavalier is a big mistake. I think there first let me say that the argument that extinction is natural is a good solid argument in scientific terms, but for contemporary extinction, it's clear that humans are at the core of it, and that the pace of extinction is so high
that we're causing it.
Yeah, and yeah. That we need to reflect on our impact on the natural world that we depend on. And the pace at which we're causing extinction needs to be slowed. It can't be written off as the natural sort of, you know, chain of events that we expect to happen.
Dr. Stern, same kind of question. And the way you talked about the way your feelings progressed in seeing Todd's work with the Lost Bird Project and then feeling this call to do more environmental work, does it line up in the same way? Are you concerned that speaking generally, mankind is a little bit cavalier about this notion that our population grows, and unfortunately, this bird might be extinct, or this bird. It's a little bit too cavalier.
I don't put it as cavalier.
Mm-hmm.
I put it as not being aware.
Ignorant as opposed to indifferent?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes, yeah. Ignorant. So when here we are in Rochester, New York, looking around, beautiful day, lots of bird song, things pretty much business as usual, and someone's telling us things are not as usual, but there isn't much direct experience of that. You read the last issue of Audubon Magazine, and they summarize their last 6 years of research and say that half of the bird species of North America in some number of years, 50 years, will have no habitat or a tremendously reduced habitat.
Half
of the species. And many of those will have no habitat at all and won't be here. So there's a disconnect between what you see when you walk outside and what you read. And what we try to do is make what you read seem real, bring it into the backyard so that when it's in the backyard, it's not possible to be cavalier about it.
Before I get to the phones, Rick and Brighton, we're coming to you next because I know you want to talk about extinct birds as well. But let me ask both Dr. Stern and Todd the question. What do you say to people who will say, all right, I grant the point that I'm ignorant about the question of extinction, and I don't mean to be indifferent when it's presented to me, but I don't know how to stop it. Societally, whether it's in my own life, in my own small sphere, or speaking globally, I don't know how to stop it. You know, and I'm going to make a strange comment here, but this is the argument I heard just a week ago. I heard two people talking about the question of population. And someone said, there's no way this planet can sustain a doubling of the human population without mass extinction, maybe huge problems with food supply, climate, et cetera. And someone said, well, maybe the Chinese have it right. Maybe population requirement limits are actually a sustaining force for the globe. And look, I mean, it feels flippant to think about it, but I don't know, Dr. Stern, you said you're trying to be humble. No one has a great answer. What do you think? People don't know how to stop it.
Yes, that's true, and I don't either. But there are some things that are clear. Something enormous is happening. The environment is deteriorating with respect to us living in it rapidly and globally. That is a true thing that's happening. It is too big for an individual acting by themselves
yeah.
to make any difference. And it may be too big, say some climate scientists, for us collectively to make any difference at all. But here we are, and this we'll get to talking about the local film festival here,
yep.
but if we're going to make any difference, it is my belief it's coming together as communities. That is going to be the basic essential tool, a community that is connected around environmental issues and speaks with a loud voice, locally, regionally, state level, and beyond.
So step one, eliminate the ignorance. You don't believe it's indifference. You believe it's ignorance. You eliminate the ignorance.
I would say two things. Eliminate the ignorance and create the community around awareness.
Todd, what do you think when you hear people say, I just don't know how to prevent this?
You know, again, I think making groups is the right answer, and I think connecting to groups that are invested in turning the situation around. So, you know, Audubon groups are the Nature Conservancy. There are plenty of organizations that are pooling their talents, their interests, and coming up with strategies that people can join in. For the most part, when I meet people and they say it's inevitable, there's nothing I can do about it, it's normally a person that's not very engaged. They haven't really pursued it very fully. I work with scientists who are keenly aware of the challenges we face, and they're the hardest working. And often, despite the fact that they're most aware of the challenge, they're also most engaged, most busy, and are usually the people who are most aware of the progress we're making. And to the point specifically about population, we can talk about this a bit later if you'd like, but you know, we're working specifically on a film currently about forest elephants, Well, forest elephants, 60% of them have been killed in the past 10 years. Well, that's a fact no one knows.
Killed by people?
Killed by people.
Poachers?
Poachers.
Poachers.
For ivory. The desire for ivory has nothing to do with population. That just has to do with our consuming habits. Mm-hmm. And consuming habits can be changed. There are lots of things we don't do anymore because we recognize that they were harmful to our environment. You know, this country does a pretty good job at not littering. There was a time when there was littering was just, you know, you just threw your wrappers on the ground. We don't do that anymore. It's a simple example, but cultures can change. Our eating habits, our consuming habits. And in that case, if we don't change the habits of buying ivory, 15 years, there will be no elephants in Central Africa. I mean, that's a fact. So getting that fact out, putting some pressure on the markets that the market forces that are driving that extinction, it's quite doable. I mean, I'm hopeful that it can be done.
We had a conversation on this program 2 weeks ago with a woman who runs an Institute for Humane Education. And her point is, look at the clothes that she said, look at all the products we buy, but start with the clothing. Think about where the clothing comes from. And if it's not made in this country, do we care to find out if it's made by children under forced labor? Do we care to find out the conditions? We probably should. And if we knew, would we change our habits? And she said the same thing about the way animals are treated, whether they're mistreated before they become our food, or they're mistreated or poached or become products that threaten their existence. I tend to agree with what Dr. Stern and Todd are saying. I think most of people are not indifferent. They're just ignorant. But there does take, it does require a little bit of a spark in us to decide to try to get past our ignorance. And me too. I mean, I think everybody. I could go back and look at my closet at home, and I'd probably be somewhat embarrassed when I start going through my food label. I say food labels and clothing labels to find out where it's coming from.
Yeah. The biggest challenge is that we now live in a system where if you say you want to clean up your behavior, it's really quite hard. You can say, I don't want to buy anything manufactured in a factory that I can't understand the social conditions behind it, and that's right. Extremely difficult. But there are very promising initiatives in our culture that you can point to and say, well, look at how great that is. There are farm markets now everywhere, farm markets all over the United States. You can buy locally grown food in season, and it tastes better. And you can go to restaurants that are making sure that they're working with, you know, very conscious about their ingredients. And that's a new thing, and it's a great thing. And I'm being concerned about the environment. I often point to the slow food movement and other similar movements, the gardening movement and home gardening, and think, you know, it can be done, and it can be done joyfully. I mean, nobody complains about farm markets. They're fabulous. It's just great to be able to buy direct, buy local, buy in season, and it's much easier to do that now than it was 10 years ago.
All right, let me grab a phone call. This is Rick in Brighton. Go ahead, Rick.
Hi, and I apologize. I just tuned in, so some of the things I'm asking about may have already been addressed, but I have a comment and a question, both pretty quick. First, a comment regarding to this issue of educating about extinctions, et cetera, and it seems to me that people tend, unfortunately, to really focus mainly on their own self-interest, and it seems to me in order to address the broadest swath of the population, maybe in education you want to try to focus as much as possible how loss of biodiversity and also lack of genetic diversity within a species or population directly impacts people, you know, as far as economy, culture, society, and that seems to be, you know, important. And then the question is if I'm not mistaken, was it not that at least recently there was a version of one of the statues in the front of the Harley School?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, the passenger pigeons in front of the Harley School.
Is that still there?
Yes, it is.
Ah, okay. And so, and then I guess one last thing I just would ask is there any plans to expand this statue program, say, to extinct birds on other continents or updating North American birds that are more recently extinct?
Yeah, I have sketches and models for both the Eskimo curlew and the slender-billed curlew. So those are two species that are, you know, one North American and one European, and I have a particular interest in those extinctions because of that fact that it seems as since we have lost these two species on two continents, it may be a way to bridge the concern, you know, across the pond, which I would love to see happen, you know, and birds in particular, they don't care about boundaries. It doesn't matter. These bird species may have met in the Arctic and then migrate to different areas, but the forces that are leading to their extinction are the same. So telling the story internationally, I think, would be, I'm motivated to do it.
I would like to just add and thank the caller for bringing up the strategy of relating loss of biodiversity to us. And I hear this all the time, and I have several reactions to it. One is that it presumes we really know how we depend on the earth and everything that grows on the earth to sustain us. And we don't. And any scientist will tell you most of the species on Earth have yet to be identified. So actually how many we're losing, what percent we're losing, can't possibly be known. There is so much we don't know, we can't really say that the loss of this species or that species will have no impact at all. The other thing that comes to mind when I hear that is that when we talk about the environment, it's out there. It does not include us. It's like there's something out there and we have to figure out how to relate to it as though it were separate, as though it were something else. And it's not. We are part of it. We depend on it. Everything you have ever held in your hand comes from the earth. It can't be otherwise. So I think the connections run deeper than we're aware about.
To that point, Dr. Stern, you know, we've been talking about the lost birds from the Lost Bird Project in a way that, yes, the Todd's sculptures and film can memorialize, but it's easy to think about them and think, well, it's sad we lost them there in the past, instead of thinking, we can't know, but I wonder about the actual impact on other species, the environment, human life. I mean, that's an interesting consideration. That is one that I don't often think about when it comes to extinction, probably because it's hard to quantify or know it. But the impact is not zero, right?
No. No. No, there are many examples of loss of species having direct impacts on us. We are losing much of our nutrition. The sea stocks, fish stocks, are down 90% worldwide. They feed billions of people.
One good example, and that just the first that came to Dr. Stern's mind. If you're just joining us, Dr. Andy Stern is here, executive director of the Lost Bird Project. Todd McGrane is an artist with the Lost Bird Project. He's a filmmaker and a film festival juror for the Fast Forward Film Festival. And Nora Brown is here, the executive director of the Rochester Finger Lakes Film and Video Office. And I don't know, Nora, I mean, I got sidetracked just talking about the environment with these guys, but you see, doesn't take long to see the remarkable impact that art can have on the way we talk about the environment.
Yeah, and you know, when we're talking about the Fast Forward Film Festival, that's really special to our office because it's reaching out to local and regional filmmakers, you know, to submit their projects and their art for this festival.
All right, so let's do this. Let's take a very short break. Dr. Stern and Todd, can you hang around for a few more minutes here? Because, I mean, let's do this. Let's take a short break. We'll come back, talk about the Fast Forward Film Festival. Nora's got all kinds of interesting stuff that we can talk about when it comes to film in general in this region. And it feels like we're in a bit of a boom time for film and artist creation. But we're going to talk about that as well in our second half hour. So much more on that, the Fast Forward Film Festival, right here on Arts Friday on member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, human rights and capitalism. Well, in some ways, there are questions about how well they go hand in hand, and we're talking about that in our first hour on this coming Monday. A group is looking at Human Rights Day, and this year's theme is human rights and capitalism. Can they coexist? Join the conversation on Monday on Connections.
Redwoods, the Grand Canyon. To protect them, conservationist Martin Litton had no room for compromise.
He felt that negotiating was to concede defeat before the fight had even started. And I think that was a central element, not only of how he conducted himself as a conservationist, but how he lived his life as a human being.
Remembering Martin Litton today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
The connection of art to the environment is our subject in this hour of Arts Friday. The Fast Forward Film Festival will be the first of its kind. And Dr. Stern, they were giving you the credit for thinking up the Fast Forward Film Festival. But now that we've talked about Lost Bird and some of your own sentimentality about using art to connect to the environment and making us sort of push that conversation forward, tell us about the Fast Forward Film Festival's goals, and we'll get into how people can get involved.
Okay, so the idea is to bring filmmaking locally to the Rochester community, and one of the guidelines for the festival is we do not accept any submissions that are from outside our local community. The intention is for this to be of and about Rochester, New York.
So what's the border of our community?
We have discussed that at length and have not defined it with a micrometer. Yeah. It is not Syracuse. It is not Buffalo.
Okay, there you go.
Our first film submission was from Israel that we rejected. It is not Rochester.
Well, that's Israel's interesting. It is not Rochester.
So I'm very excited about the festival, and here are my ideas about goals for it.
Sure.
One thing that I've become aware of as I've traveled all over the country is there's a ton of people who care deeply about the environment and are already know more about it than I do and are deeply engaged with work addressing their own environmental concerns. So I just want in Rochester for those people in that category to meet each other, because there is quite a bit of fragmentation in this community and all local communities. So it's just, first of all, just bringing that group together and saying, wow, there are more of us than we thought. So that's one purpose. A second purpose is a teaching purpose, education, raising awareness. If you make a film about the environment, you have to learn something about it. If you present it to others, they will learn what you learned. So there will be learning about the environment and they'll be learning about filmmaking, both. We want it to be fun. We want this to be a blast. We want to have giggles doing it. So just kind of a uplift. So much of environmental work is kind of deflating, depressing. That is not our idea here at all. We want, as a community, to have fun doing this. It's a celebration of our community. And then it's an invitation for those who care about the environment but don't know how to get involved to consider what calls to them. How might they step up if they're called to do that and find their way to engage with the problem? So that, I suppose that's how I would summarize our goals.
And looking at the entry details, films are 5 minutes or less,
mm-hmm.
right? 5 minutes or less, all genre and styles of film.
Yep.
Accepted. The submission deadline is February 27th, so you've got still have almost 3 months, and no entry fee to do that. So it's quite egalitarian.
We wanted to make the playing field level. We didn't want to charge. We wanted to make it short so that even a person or a younger person who has never made a film before could take a shot at it. So yes, we're hoping for submissions from a very diverse group of filmmakers.
Okay, and if people want to make a submission, or if you know a filmmaker in your life, someone maybe a film student, maybe a professional filmmaker, somebody who just cares about the environment, thinks this sounds like a cool idea, they can submit where, Dr. Stern?
They go to our website, which is fastforwardroc.org, and all of the details of the submission criteria are listed there. There are too many, and I don't remember all of them. but there are certain formats and certain other issues which are all detailed there.
This all is going to result in a 2-day film festival at the Little Theater and the Dryden in April. And again, so that'll be in April, the Little and the Dryden, fastforwardroc.org. Todd, 5 minutes or less, for anybody who hasn't made a film before, that's a challenge, but it doesn't, in fact, in some ways, I think it really helps you sharpen a message and a focus. What do you think about 5 minutes or less as an outline?
I think the short format's fantastic. It suits, in a way, the kind of, cultural move now. I mean, let's see if we can condense our thoughts into very potent and really expressive individual artist-driven statements, in film form, and I think the short is a great format. I also think in a more general sense, now is a great time to invite people to be filmmakers. It's a great time to ask, you know, professional filmmakers to consider this subject and consider it in a short format. In a world where it's easy for people to say everything is getting worse, one of the things that's unquestionably fantastic is, you know, our access to filmmaking equipment. Who would have imagined that filmmaking equipment would mean a phone and a very inexpensive editing program? You know, the only reason that I'm able to make films is because it's become much more sort of available to the people in general. The democratization of filmmaking has been advanced significantly because of technology. And it's wonderful to live in a time when that's the case, when we can get stories from people who don't have to have a big institutional infrastructure behind them. And in some ways, the short format makes that even more likely. You know, it's manageable with very limited amount of equipment to put together a really beautiful and powerful 5-minute film on the environment. And we're looking forward to seeing them.
For somebody who has focused a lot of work on extinct species, you're a pretty positive and optimistic person.
You know, I definitely have low periods, but, you know, in general, my optimism is, again, based on engagement. You know, if you don't get involved, you never come across all of the people who are working so hard to make a difference. And, you know, my involvement in art about the environment has meant that I've had to find subjects who are engaged in the environment, and those people are inspiring. I have been very fortunate to spend large amounts of my adult life around very inspiring people. And in recent years, it's been about the environment, meeting people who are in the trenches doing the good work. And it is very inspiring. Makes me optimistic, hopeful.
Listeners, if you want to join in with a conversation about the environment, about conservation, about art and the way it connects to the environment, or questions about the Fast Forward Film Festival, the number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Film Commissioner Nora Brown, we have a lot of film festivals in this area. I mean, we are rich in festivals. And yet, each one, at least that I've seen, seems to have its unique flavor and focus and identity. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. And I think a lot of it has to do with that we've always been a really strong film culture anyway. And then when you throw the diversity in of the different kinds of festivals, there's a lot of people in this area that love films, that just eat up going to the film, go to see films.
And when it comes to the creation of film in our area, whether it's, again, something this wide open to anybody with a mobile phone, all the way up to professional filmmakers, what have we seen in terms of the growth of this region? Give me kind of a snapshot of what this region is doing when it comes to film.
Well, I would say probably in the last 3 years or so, we have seen an increase in interest in shooting in upstate New York.
What's that coming from?
The film incentives that New York State has.
The incentives, yeah.
But as far as Rochester is concerned, you know, we're the strongest infrastructure outside of New York City. We have the most experienced crew people. We have the strongest support services and the deepest base of infrastructure that's really outside of New York City. You're going to find it here. You're going to find it in Rochester. And you wouldn't normally expect that in a city our size, but because of Kodak for so many years producing their film stock and testing it, doing demos, and you know, the crew just got the experience, and with it came the grip and electric companies and all the services that you need to go with it.
Nora, when we look at film incentives, you know, the government's got to decide what they think is a good return on investment, but clearly studios are responding then. I mean, we obviously saw that here in Rochester on a big scale with Spider-Man, but clearly there is a response that's happening. Yeah?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you know, you don't have to sell New York City very hard. That's where the films are made, you know, and so that's where a large percentage of the film incentive budget goes every year. The money that's set aside for the film incentive program, a large percentage of it goes to New York City. More and more is coming upstate because you can do a lower budget film, not be a high tier. You know, there's different levels, different tiers. So be in a lower tier, only have to shoot one day on a soundstage, take advantage of the more affordable locations, more affordable crew, just make it a little smaller film, but save money actually by doing it outside of New York City.
I was going to say, when it comes to New York City, sure, it may be seem like an easy choice. It's probably more expensive to rent just about anything there, or simply just to get around. I mean, Rochester was used as a substitute for Manhattan, and it came off decently well on screen. I mean, I think it was fine.
I think it came off great.
Okay, it came off great, we'll say, sure. But it has to be more convenient for a studio if Rochester can be effective as Manhattan, for example. It's got to be more effective because renting anything is going to be less expensive here. You know, yeah, there was a bit of a traffic upheaval here, but not like there would be in Manhattan. So I would think infrastructurally and logistically, there would be a compelling reason to choose Rochester if it comes down to that.
For special shots like that,
sure.
In New York City, you're not allowed to exceed the speed limit on the city streets. So, you know, going down Main Street at 50 miles an hour with a Porsche Cayenne with a Russian arm and all the action going on.
A what arm? A Russian arm?
Oh, it's called a Russian arm. It comes out of the top of the black Porsche that was following. I'm sure you saw.
I did see the movie, but I'm trying to remember.
The camera car is a Porsche Cayenne.
Okay, I gotcha.
And so then over the top, that piece of equipment is called a Russian arm. And that's what drove along the sidewalk and followed the action down Main Street. So that was never going to happen in Chinatown. We were supposed to be Chinatown. Mm-hmm. And there was no way they were going to be able to shut down Chinatown for 10 days to get all the shots that they needed. So looking upstate, they picked Rochester because of our infrastructure and also because of our Main Street. Now we do it really, really well, and they know that. Filmmakers know that. The studios know. The location scout who was with Spider-Man is now with one of the studios. So he's sending people our way.
Are there more big productions coming?
Gosh, I don't know.
You do know. You're not allowed to say?
You know, I'm really not. I wish that I could. I wish I could brag about every project, but, you know, we're helping people to protect their intellectual property as much as we are just trying to keep this secret for them.
All right, so Nora's not going to break any news right now, but the bottom line is there are reasons to be excited.
Well, there's always people looking. I mean, we've had people looking since Spider-Man drove away, since the trucks all left. We've had people looking, and there's some that show real promise.
And that's the biggest stage. Are there people who, have you seen filmmakers start small, submit to a film festival, whether it's Fast Forward or something else, and all of a sudden, success on that kind of a stage sparks new creation?
Maybe not so much on a regional level, but we have met a lot of filmmakers and then looked back at other works that they've done, mm-hmm. and it just keeps getting a little bigger and a little better if that's where they want to go. You know, some filmmakers just want to make their films.
Yes.
They don't really care about getting,
sure.
you know.
I guess it depends on what your motivation is, right?
Yes.
I mean, you talked to Todd and Dr. Stern, and it sounds like, I don't know, Dr. Stern, it sounds like part of your motivation. Well, first of all, you mean you're giving up a career in neurology for this. That's true.
This will be my last year of practice. That's true.
Because you've been so moved by this.
Exactly.
This passion.
Exactly.
I mean, that's a pretty remarkable thing.
Well, it's the clarity there for me is there. This is what I'm called to do, so that's what I'm going
to
do.
Yeah, so we can talk to Nora about people who want to become great big filmmakers, but for you it seems more like an intrinsic value or community-oriented
effort. Loved practicing neurology. I've done it for over 30 years. It's always been fulfilling in every way, and now I'm shifting to a different direction, and that's how it is.
Did you ever expect something like that would happen?
Never. 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 No, I thought I was there for life. absolutely. I would just like to go back to Nora for a moment and talk about bragging. She's a humble person, but it is Nora really who's responsible for bringing Spider-Man to Rochester and for creating the incentives. And so I would just like to make mention of that. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. But we didn't actually create the incentives. What we created was a bump in the incentive for upstate. You know, it was just
that sounds like creating the incentives, but you're right.
Yeah. Just but just let me give you a quick story, because explaining to lawmakers the imbalance was not really easy, because you can't give them numbers. So in the course of the 3 years that I was talking about, $1.1 billion went into this program over 3 years. And so I took a jelly bean jar, and I put 1,100 jelly beans into this jar, and I went to the different lawmakers who could help us and said, out of $1.1 billion in this pool in the last 3 years, how much do you think went to films upstate? And, you know, they all would take 10 out or whatever, and it was one. Out of $1.1 billion, $1 million was split up between films that shot in Rochester, Buffalo, and Syracuse. So they understood that it really that we need to incentivize filmmakers to come upstate, and mostly low budget independent stuff. They can really benefit from this 10%. So I didn't start the film incentive in New York, but I definitely worked with the Buffalo Film Commissioner to get the bump for upstate.
But Nori, there are people who will be cynical about the notion of tax incentives for studios that ostensibly are making millions of dollars, and I know you hear that.
Mm-hmm.
So just for a moment, talk to me about that debate that happens. Again, you're not creating that incentive. Lawmakers are. You're leveraging what is out there and what's available, because mm-hmm. that's part of your job. But when you hear that debate about, is there a return on investment or is this an appropriate use of a tax incentive, what do you say?
Well, obviously, I say yes, because tax incentives, film incentives, mean jobs. Not just jobs for people who work in the film industry, not just for the crew, not just for the people who own the Grip and Electric companies, but when Spider-Man was here, they hired local people. They used a construction company to bring in their jersey barriers. They used the caterers. They bought all their groceries here. They went to the hardware store. And every single one of the people who came from out of town was given money every day, per diem money, because they, you know, they're out of town. They have to go buy dinner and stuff. So they went to the restaurants, and the restaurants have wait staff that get the tips, and the dry cleaners have staff there. And so it's not just jobs for people that are in the film industry, but it's really the whole region. Those people who and then make the extra money when Spider-Man's in town, they're going to go out to dinner somewhere, or they're going to go out and spend their money at the grocery store, whichever one they choose to go to. And then, you know, so it really trickles down. So every dollar in production money, the production spending, really multiplies to $2.30. So the impact on the economy for every dollar is $2.30. You're right about the studios. The only thing about New York State is that we don't pay above the line. It's only below the line. So it's tangible items. It's spending in New York State. It's not writer, producer, director, and actors who are going to get the big salaries. It's based on tangible items, and they're spending in New York.
Well, Dr. Stern, has enough nice things to say about Nora. I should say something nice about Todd McGrane. I mean, Todd is the winner of the 2014 Audubon Award for Art Inspiring Conservation. And one of our listeners online, Bill, wanted to know, we've been talking about extinct birds, wanted to know if you are going to move your efforts into other species outside of birds in terms of looking at extinction. And we talked a little bit, you talked about elephants and other things.
Yeah, I think for the coming years, this project on forest elephants is going to be taking most of my artistic time. It's a very different project because it's an endangered species. They are, you know, severely endangered, but unlike telling the stories of extinction, telling the stories of extinction has the hope of making us aware of what we are at risk of losing. Telling the stories of an animal at risk has a much more proactive goal, which is, you know, to see whether or not art and telling the story and communication about an endangered species can lead to some better management, and in a deeper sense, a better relationship to our environment that will prevent that extinction.
Preventing other extinctions.
Yeah.
When it comes to the birds, what have you seen? What has come out of the Lost Bird Project in a way that, you know, before I get back to the phones and I see them ringing again, give me a sense for, since the Lost Bird Project launched, have you heard from others? Have you worked in a way that indicates to you that there is hope that maybe prevention of other extinctions could happen?
I think maybe the most direct example of that is, you know, we went down to Florida where the last Carolina parakeets were seen, and to the specific site where the last eggs, which was, you know, the sort of last record of this bird species that we have real evidence for, was the collecting of these eggs. So egg collectors went in, they found the last eggs known from the Carolina parakeets, and for a profit sold them, and because they were scarce and prized items. Well, while we're down there telling that sad story, we meet the naturalist who's there, whose every waking moment is about saving the Florida grasshopper sparrow. He works tirelessly. He tells that story. And so the memorial's now there. It's the place they start their interpretive talks. They start their interpretive talks with the loss of the Carolina parakeet, and they end them with the efforts, their heroic efforts to save that Florida grasshopper sparrow. And while it's a tall order to save that species, it's inspiring to me, and it's wonderful to tell the story that in the presence of such loss, people are committed to prevent it. And I think it is inspiring. It inspires me.
Todd, is there a rule of thumb about imminent extinction once a population gets down to a certain number that it's not savable?
No, it's difficult because, and this is actually something new to me. It turns out that a lot of species that are in great number may be at risk. It's because a lot of species that we know of as being large populations need large populations. So a species like the cod, for example, you know, it gets below a certain number, it's difficult to sustain, even if that number seems high. You say, well, there's a lot of those fish, but the species needs, you know, really big numbers to continue. It's sort of the tadpole, you know, idea that some species you really need large numbers to continue. So, but I would say, just in general, we have to keep species from getting so low that their you know, genetic material is going to be spread too thin, and keep our eye on habitat, and make sure that we're not, you know, just creating kind of zoos without walls, because habitats are so small that nothing can, you know, survive in that limited resource.
Back to the phones as we talk about the Fast Forward Film Festival, the inaugural event that's coming to Rochester with a deadline for submissions for artists on February 27th. So you have until February 27th to submit at fastforwardrock.org. This is Lisa. Lisa, thanks for calling Connections.
Yeah, of course. I'm excited to be on the air.
Go ahead.
All right. So I just have a quick question. I was browsing through your website, and I noticed a certain tab that said resources. And under that, it says Friends of the Festival. Now, how does a filmmaker get in touch with a friend of the festival?
Well, thank you for asking that. We have had phenomenal support from the community. We have, I don't know how many, quote, friends, unquote, but the entire community has stepped up and made themselves available to filmmakers, everything from actors to locations to information to film equipment to cameras. The way to access all that is to go to the website fastforwardrock.org and then submit your question via email, and we will connect you with the proper resource for your need. The person who is managing this, who I should really give credit to, her name is Becca Delaney, has done a phenomenal job in canvassing the Rochester community for our friends and for these resources for filmmakers. We really would like to take down the barriers for people who are called to make a film. So thanks for asking.
Does that answer your question, Lisa?
Yes, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, Lisa, thanks for the call. If you're just kind of joining the program, we're wrapping up in just a few minutes as we talk about the Fast Forward Film Festival. As you heard Dr. Stern say, it's fastforwardrock.org. Is there a goal for how many films you'd like to show in April?
I don't have a number in my mind. The more the better. I have focused, and others have focused on making the space for this community to produce mind-blowing, wonderful, moving films. And I know they're on the way, and I will let you know when the time comes.
But you want to see a good amount of submissions by February 27th. So.
I would love to.
The first one really came in from Israel.
Yeah.
They didn't read the guidelines,
right? No, they
right?
didn't read the guidelines.
I mean, it's probably an honor to get a film submitted from Israel, but they want local films there. And so we'll see. Todd, do you have an idea in mind for what you'd like to see as a juror? I mean, is there a number or kind of a broad outline?
No, I mean, it depends a bit on how long the entries are, because under 5 minutes, there could be a lot of quite short films if they work at that length. And I guess as a juror, you know, I would say this is where, if you're in the listening audience, you get out your pen. I'd say specifically what I'm looking for is something that I have no ability to define at this moment.
Here I was thinking.
Something unexpected, something, you know, okay. Something that we really wouldn't predict, something, you know, that's there's an individual voice and an individual vision that just strikes you as a new and I'm looking forward to seeing that. I know that it'll be the case.
All right, so I got 30 seconds left here. What am I missing for the festival? Did we miss any details, Dr. Stern?
I do want to add one thing.
Yes, please do.
Follow up with Todd. It's not entirely true. We do have three categories, and they do express somewhat the universes we're looking for. The first category is the most inspiring, compelling, and engaging film. The second category is most unique perspective. And the third is the strongest call to action. There will be a winner for each of those categories. They will receive a $1,000 prize, and then there will be a $250 prize for runner-ups in those categories.
Okay, so, but I think what Todd is saying is think creatively. Think differently, right?
Yep.
It's something that we haven't seen before. It is fastforwardrock.org for more details on that. Dr. Andy Stern, you know, you're retiring as a neurologist, so I'd love to bring you back sometime. I know you got nothing to do in the new year, right? Come back and talk to us sometime.
Anytime.
Congratulations on Lost Bird and on this festival as well.
Thank you so much, Adam.
Todd, inspiring stuff. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nora Brown, always good to talk about what's going on in our region with film, and thank you for sharing the Film Office perspective with us.
Thanks for having me.
And all of our wonderful listeners, thank you for listening on this Arts Friday. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.